Good morning, my name is Keegan Rasko, and I'd like to welcome you to Life Downstream. Life Downstream is a radio show where I, a high school student, and my high school English teacher, Mr. Andrew Morgan, go and talk to interesting people from all over about their life experiences and how those life experiences allowed them to learn outside of a classroom. And with that, I'd like to throw it over to Mr. Morgan to introduce our guest for today.
So we're here today with Cindy Price, current Astoria Planning Commissioner, former city councilor, avid gardener. Cindy, thanks so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thanks for calling me. Happy to be here.
So I wanted to kind of pick your brain a little bit about some of the things that you've done over the years. Can we start hearing a little bit about your work as a, what was the official title with this work you did with the UN? A rapporteur?
I was a conference rapporteur. It grew out of a job that I had at a small think tank that was based in Marina Del Rey and also had a little shop in Washington, D.C. The company was called Panheuristics. It had been started by a man, a theoretical mathematician, who was one of the original members of the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica. And the other director was had also been at RAND, but he was an economist and was at the Hoover Institution in Stanford. And so for hearing these things, you might think that it was a little bit right of center think tank, and in fact it was. We got a lot of money during the Reagan-Bush years and less in the years that followed.
I'm really curious because I feel like we hear this term on the news a lot, and how many people actually know what goes on in a think tank? Can you tell us a little bit about, like, think tank? What does that involve? Like, what?
A lot of thinking.
Yes,
you do a lot of thinking.
I hope.
Well, the way ours worked, there were about 30 people, probably 10 junior analysts, 10 senior analysts, and 10 assistants of some sort. We got large contracts from the Secretary of Defense and also from an agency that I think is not existing now, the Defense Nuclear Agency. And we were looking at NATO affairs, what was going on in the NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organizations, American, European strategic plans. How are we going to defeat the Russians? But we tried to do things that were outside of the box. Most of the work that was being done at the time thought about Soviet tanks coming over the Fulda Gap. What would you do? We were the first, really, I think, to ever talk about the Persian Gulf and oil and coming through Afghanistan Iran and trying to seize those areas. So the way it worked was you came to work, usually a little late. You sat around and you our doors were always open. It was a very eclectic group of people. We had a contract to advise the Secretary of Defense on certain things, and so that's what we did. Most of the good work came from standing in somebody's doorway and saying, I can't figure out what to write next. I'm at this point, blah, blah, blah. And then maybe you'd talk about your night and your girlfriend or your boyfriend, and something would come up and you go, hey, thanks. And you go back to your office and you'd write, you know, a little more.
So are you saying basically the government would have contracts with these private think tanks, these private organizations that would advise them on
policy,
huge decisions? And
yes,
some of that advice came about from just very casual conversations. And then
well,
would you guys,
there was
you guys
a lot
would
of research
then,
involved
I was say,
too, but yes.
What was involved with that?
Well, I'll tell you one of the things that I remember doing, I started working there in 1979, 1980. So this was pre-computer really, right? So one of the things I remember doing is that we were supposed to be looking at collateral damage should there be a limited nuclear war in Europe.
Okay.
Right? Because at the time, there were these intermediate nuclear range weapons in Europe. It was a great big controversy. So what would happen? And the government was talking about the possibility of limited nuclear war. So what would happen? So I had maps of all of the NATO bases in Europe. I had a map, and it showed where the hangars were and where airplanes were. And then I cut out a little piece of manila folder in the width of the diameter of, or the radius of a small nuclear bomb. I put a pin through the middle of it. I measured it out very nicely. I put a pin through the middle of it, and I would put this pin various places on the map of these NATO bases and spin it around, and I would see whether, if you put a bomb here, a small nuclear warhead here, would you kill the people in the village on the other side of the fence? And that was the kind of stuff we did. I mean, that was, I mean, that sounds kind of ridiculous, but well, that is the kind of thing we did.
I was going to say, what, you know, what did that experience, what impression did that kind of leave with you about the way that some of these huge decisions are made?
Because well, I feel time, like it made all kinds of sense. There wasn't, you know, we didn't have big computers or anything. How were you going to, how else were you going to do it? Everything was done very, you know, manually, digitally.
Yeah, I guess as somebody
by hand.
I guess as somebody who's not, you know, as familiar with this whole process and what goes on behind the scenes, it sounds shocking that, wow, some of these massively important decisions that affect so many different people, they could come down to two or three analysts in this office building coming up with a report that lands on someone's desk, you know?
Yeah, and then you're sitting there making decisions about, you know, nuclear warheads, and then somehow you land in a town of 10,000 people. So,
well, there was a lot of space in between.
No, but I mean, what? How does that change your perspective, especially in a small town like ours? Like, what kind of? How did that decision making process? I mean, being a part of something so big, what was that transfer like when you come to Astoria later?
Basically, what you're talking about is working in a small company doing important things. So maybe it transfers to maybe being on city council or being on planning commission, and you are just one or two or seven, five or seven people, and you are making big decisions. You're sitting at a table with nothing but a piece of paper in front of you and a little information and hashing out amongst your colleagues how to design a city. This is how to design a strategic force or a strategic plan or something. It's all basically the same. Hmm. All politics is personal, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's advantageous for Astoria. I mean, being able, like, not a lot of people, once they get into a seat like that, like being a city councilor or being a planning commissioner, they have that prior experience with understanding how to make a strategic plan.
Right.
There's so many people that don't understand how different it is once you get into that chair.
True. And really, the experience that I had at this little company, Panheuristics, our boss was Albert Wolfstetter, and he was a bit of an iconoclast. He could have been as famous as Henry Kissinger, but he eschewed all of that. He really was just a very serious person. And he didn't, he was Einsteinian in the way that he believed very much that it wasn't the answer. The answers were easy to get. It's the question. You had to come up really with the right question. And that is really what we spent a lot of our time on. I gave you this little silly example, but that was really what we spent a lot of our time on, was trying to get the people who make decisions, to really think of what are the questions that they should be asking. Mm-hmm. To get an answer that makes sense. And that is, that's hard to do.
Could you give us an example of one of those? Do you remember any of those where it really, you know, a lot of research went into coming up with the phrasing of a certain question?
Well, I would just say that I can't think of any one example, because it just permeated everything that we did. It had to do with the fact that while much of the research that was being done at larger corporations, at RAND, and what the government was talking about, again, was, a Soviet invasion through the Fulda Gap with tanks, we were looking at, no, that's not the way things would happen. That would start World War III. And the Soviet Union doesn't want to start World War III, but they might want to have the oil in the Persian Gulf because they need that. Or at the time, it was the general consensus was that the Soviet Union was a monolith, that all of the, you know, it's a huge thing with all of these countries and parts of countries. But even in the 70s and earlier on in the 60s, you had the Prague Spring and all of that. So you knew that these people were different. There were fault lines in the Soviet Union, and you could exploit them in ways. So we were trying to look at things, come at it from a little bit different angle than the general consensus.
Interesting. Cool.
Yeah. I mean, you must do that too, right? You're a teacher, right?
Yeah. I mean, this
don't you
this
try
whole...
to come into your class with something different?
Well, yeah. I think that idea about thinking of the right question, you know, I mean, that's such a big part of our jobs is it's, you know, how do you ask things of students in a way that is engaging and makes them, you know, more curious and, you know, I know I'm guilty of answering questions with questions sometimes, you know, and trying to kind of keep the conversation going. And I think the question is so important, you know, how you right. ask people questions. It's obviously really important.
A question that will make you connect the dots of all of the things and not just look at this one tiny little piece of the puzzle, but what's the puzzle? What mm-hmm. is the puzzle?
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing. Yeah. Comes in really handy.
Yeah. Well, so... to skip back again, how did you get into that chair? I mean, how did you get into your position, especially in this, you know, this national presence almost? What were the steps?
An ad in the paper. You know, life was so much easier. I'm old now, you know, and I came from the era where when you wanted to find a job, you looked in the newspaper. You wanted to find an apartment to rent, you looked in the newspaper. It was all there. I was working for another organization. I started out my career in publishing. I was working for another organization. I was getting a little unhappy there. And so I just looked in the paper, and I was looking for something that paid about the same amount that I was making because I wasn't making very much money anyway.
Yeah.
And there was a job to come and be an assistant for a professor and his wife who were engaged in international relations, and that had been my major in college. So, boom, and it required writing skills and editing skills, all these things that I had. So, I just fell into it.
Do you ever find yourself looking at policy decisions that are made today, and just thinking, wondering about the backstory and what went into that decision? And,
all the time.
I mean, I think it must be so interesting to kind of have this background in, you know, seeing behind the curtain for how policy is made and, you know, and then now living in a world where, you know, you get to constantly read about
right.
these policies that are made. You know?
Right. Well, it did teach me a number of things. And one was that what you read in the newspaper, even the best reporter, first of all, that you never said, oh, I like the New York Times.
Yeah.
There are good reporters and not so good reporters at the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
So you learned who to read, who you could trust, who was really reporting the facts without a lot of their own political thinking in there. And then also to read very carefully when they said something, when they wrote something, did it say may or shall or
yeah.
will? That made a big difference then. And then you also knew that you were only getting half the story, even from the best reporters, because they have limited time, limited space, and there's all this back stuff that goes on to get, particularly when you're talking about international affairs. And I still read the paper that way today, but I know that newspapers are quite different now than they were then. But it's still important.
You said earlier that you really like policy. What is it about policy that you find so interesting?
Well, it's very creative. I'm not an artist. I can barely write anymore, it seems, because I've spent so much time now as an editor, and it's a very different part of your brain. But it's just a very creative thing. You've got, again, if you're doing it right, you're looking at all of the elements that make a picture, and what are you trying to do? Are you trying to create a vision for the western part of Astoria, Uniontown Reborn? What is that? You know, what are you trying to do? Are you just trying to, maybe you're just trying to redo your house? You know, that's a policy decision too. You have to look at in terms of time and money and where you're really going with it, et cetera, resources.
So do you feel like, you know, I think if you say what comes to mind when you hear the word policy, if you stop someone on the street and said, you know, when you hear the phrase policy wonk or policy, what comes to mind? You know, I think it has this kind of negative connotation for a lot of people.
Really?
And it's interesting that you say it's creative. And I think a lot of people, when they hear the word policy, they think dry and, you know, lengthy. And,
well, it sure can be,
you know,
for sure.
And so I thought as somebody who's also really interested in language, and I thought, oh, that's an interesting adjective to use to describe policy, that it's creative, you know? And yeah.
Well, and I mean, when you walk down the street and you say policy, you know, it's not something that you're going to bring up at the Thanksgiving table with the rest of your family because it freaks people out. So, like you said, I like policy, but I don't necessarily like politics. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is policy is really thinking and really I do think it's creating. It's creating a story. It's creating a plan. Politics is when you're juggling people mostly. You're mm-hmm. juggling people and you're trying to get people on your side. You're trying to get people to understand what you're saying. You're trying to make yourself listen. Be sure that you listen to what they're saying. That's politics. That's a whole different bag. And it's hard to be, you know, at a certain point, if you're trying to sell your policy, you have to be political about it because you want to create alliances and you just want to sell your policy. But some people are just flat out political and they don't really care about all that. They just want to get elected or they want to be the boss of this, that, or the other. And I don't come at it from that way. I come at it from wanting to engage with a group of people to create something hopefully good.
Well, I mean, and if you have a particular policy that you're interested in, so like in the news a lot recently has been the riverfront plans, right? The vision plan. What's your strategy for getting that ball, you know, in the hoop, so to say? I mean, how do you get to that answer where everybody is kind of okay with what's going on? You know, how do you get there?
Well, you know, that's a different kind of policy making because that's civic policy making. Yeah. And if you're doing it as a city councilor, then you're representing your constituents. So it's not a matter of sitting in a room with, you know, 5 or 10 other like-minded people and you're shipping off a paper to one person. You have to go out and listen to what your constituents want and help to educate them so that they really understand all of the dynamics that are involved and what would try to again paint the vision for them of what would be the result of what they want and so that everyone can see. And again, then you're working collegially with on city council with 4 other councilors or 3 other councilors and a mayor, and then you've got staff and you've got whoever's funding the project, and so that's a whole different kind of policy making.
And then, I'm sorry, I was thinking about this earlier. I was actually in the room when you were accepting the plate for when you were doing city councilor. And you said something that I really want to press you on because what's this deal with the Hugh Hefner story? Where did he come from?
Well, Hugh Hefner, I did have a couple of years in the, some would call it the pornography trade. I started out in publishing, as I said. It was sort of my first jobs out of college all had to do with publishing. And in a long time ago, there was an ad in the paper. And
everything starts with an ad in the
paper. Ad in paper for a job on the 42nd floor of one of the Twin Towers in Century City in Los Angeles. These were fairly new. And I was working at a publishing company. I was a little editor, and I was making under $12,000 a year. Wow. And I wanted to do a little more, so I went and I interviewed. And this was at Larry Flint Publications. And Larry Flint had, at the time, a whole bunch of publications. Hustler, Chic, Slam, some really nasty stuff. Nastier than Hustler and Chic. And I wanted to move up in the publishing world, and there wasn't that much in Los Angeles. And so I got the courage up to tell the HR person, well, I'll take this job, but I have to make at least $12,500 a year. And she said, no problem. We start at $17,000.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, yahoo. I worked there for about 2 years. It was a really great experience because that is where all the people who wanted to be in publishing worked in Los Angeles, because there was only one other place. It was Sunset Magazine, and that was pretty much it. Peterson Magazine, which had Motor Trend or something. So that was a really great experience, actually. From there, I didn't go from there to Hugh Hefner. Hugh Hefner came about because after the think tank went out of business in the early 90s, I was living in D.C. at the time. I was the congressional and Pentagon liaison for this company and also still doing research and running this little institute. And I thought, well, I would go back to Los Angeles and I would write. Well, I spent about 6 months on my bed watching the ceiling fan going around, being unable really to write much. And a friend of mine who was a journalist and was doing a lot of the Playboy interviews at that time asked me if I would like to transcribe and edit his interviews. And so I did that for a little money until I started getting more freelance work as a conference rapporteur and other things. And that led me somehow to... Oh, somebody who was working on Hugh Hefner's autobiography.
Oh, wow.
And so he took me up to the mansion and introduced me to Mr. Hefner. And we spent, for the next 6 months, a lot of time there interviewing him, transcribing, editing, working with him on a lot of stuff. And
so you were helping, at some point you started helping with this autobiography.
With his autobiography, okay. Which I think would never got published. And the author at the time died a number of years ago.
Wow.
Yeah. Hef couldn't pull the plug on his book. So it happens.
Oh, that's interesting.
So you were transcribing, like while you were freelancing, you'd get a tape in the mail or something, and then you would just be transcribing
transcribing and editing at the same time. Transcription can be very creative as well. It can also be very boring if you happen to have that kind of transcription. But if you happen to have the kind that I had, which was to listen to it and to turn whatever they were saying into a story, then that was really interesting, and it paid very well. So
how would you do that? I mean, I guess when I hear transcription, I think, okay, you just type exactly what you hear, and it's pretty objective. Like, how does it turn into this subjective thing?
Because people talk very much differently than you would read on a piece of paper. So you're taking their voice and retaining their voice and the rhythms of their voice. But perhaps, especially for a book, you would leave out anything that the questioner was asking.
Yeah.
And then you might listen ahead, and they might be skipping ahead, so you'd bring it back up and just create a story out of what you're hearing rather than this series of questions and answers and questions and answers and ums and ahs.
So, Cindy, for 4 years, you served as a city councilor, and you are currently a planning commissioner. If you had to give some advice to, let's just say, a young person out there who has an interest in local politics, I don't know, someone named Keegan maybe, or anybody else listening to the show who might want to go down that road in the future, what would you say? What are some things that they should be mindful of, any pitfalls they should avoid?
Well, I would say Keegan is doing just the right thing. He's gotten involved at an early age. He talks to a lot of different people. He goes to a lot of different meetings, so he's gaining a real understanding of the full complement of things that the city does. So if Keegan wanted to become a city councilor at some point, he could certainly make a good case for that. So that's it. It's getting involved. I had not served on the planning commission before I became a city councilor. That's a common route, is to serve on a commission. And I have said this before, that I did not have as much appreciation of the work that the Planning Commission does as I might have as a city councilor, because the Planning Commission does all the work. I have used the analogy of Gertrude Jekyll, who is this wonderful British gardener, and she used to walk around her gardens with a manservant who had a bag of hair, rabbit, over his shoulder and a shovel and the plant in the other hand. And Gertrude would walk around and she would go, there. And she'd point to where she wanted her manservant to dig a hole and throw the hare in for fertilizer and put the tree in or shrub. And so as city councilor, you're sort of Gertrude. You just get to go, there. But the planning commissioner are the ones who were digging the holes. And And yeah. it's hard work. And so that is a great place to start. But Keegan's doing it right. You've been on, what, the Library Foundation Board mm-hmm. and Parks Board, I think.
Yeah, well, right now I'm sitting on the Maritime Memorial Board.
Maritime Memorial Board. So these are all wonderful places to start. You just got to get in there and get in amongst them and be willing to work with people. I don't think it helps to be, although, you know, see what's happening in, at the national level, and it's hard to say, but I think we're a small town still, and I think comity and civility are important here. I have a piece of advice for you, Mr. Teacher.
Yeah.
I learned something in eighth grade that was very bad for me for years. I was in an art class, and I had a lot of great ideas in art class, but I had no ability to carry them out.
You're a visionary.
I had no skills. But the art teacher always gave me A's. He gave me A's because I was thinking about it, and I was passionate, and I'd like to do it, but I just never could. But you know what? That sat with me through my 20s. I thought that I could get away with having a good idea sometimes, but no, as an adult in the working world, you actually have to produce something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's one thing to have a really great idea, and then you can still have great ideas and talk about them with your colleagues or your bosses or whatever. But I think that needs to be prefaced with, but here's what I can do.
Yeah.
You know, so that you're not setting yourself up for failure.
Do you kind of wish that teacher didn't just give you so many A's on all
these
things?
I mean, really do, because it was really detrimental to me for a while. Yeah. I finally had a good boss who kind of saw that in me and said, you know, you're giving me too many expectations. How about you just stick with what you can do?
Yeah.
And then you can build on that and get better.
Yeah.
And your vision, eventually maybe you can bring it to four.
Anything folks listening should keep on their radar in terms of Planning Commission stuff that's coming up?
Sure.
Any important stuff you want to plug here at the end?
We are working on a couple of important things, and they all have to do with the western end of Astoria, from Second Street to the port. And one is wrestling still with height limits and mass and scale of buildings on the Riverwalk in that area. Mm-hmm. And then we have settled on 28 feet, but then the mass is still allowed at 30,000 square feet, so you could have some extremely long sort of whales of buildings, which is not what we want in the Bridge Vista. So we haven't come up yet with a plan to allow development but preserve views. And then in early August, we're having an extra session on the Uniontown Reborn project, which looks further into Uniontown up to Bond Street and also at the ODOT changes that are being thought of. And so this is really interesting on the policy point of view, is how to connect all of that and have it all make sense. And really, what is the vision of the West End of Astoria? No one has settled on that yet. Yeah. So we're sort of creating that from thin air.
It's exciting.
It is. Cool.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
So this is the portion of the show where I offer my student perspective on our guest speaker today. And what stood out to me most about Cindy was that she was a shining example of transferable skills. Each one of us has a set of prior experiences and prior knowledge that we can use to apply to our current goals and our current tasks. And Cindy represents that this strategy is tried and true and can help us solve problems that we never thought we would be able to.